Good evening. Good evening. My name is Bryn McNamee Tweed, and I'm a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the College Farm and the Departments of Earth Sciences, Religion, and Anthropology, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Thought for Food. The Pure Drug and Food Act of 1906 was the first of more than 200 public health and consumer protection laws that Congress later enacted. More than 100 years after this law was enacted, the Food and Drug Administration and the United States Department of Agriculture produce food safety standards and provide leadership on food, agriculture, and natural resources based on sound public policy, the best available science, and efficient management. The policies created by these two government bureaucracies have broad effects on the health and equality of the food Americans eat. The resulting food production system creates enough food for every American, but some commentators question its equity, safety, health, and sustainability. From school lunch programs and the obesity epidemic to poverty and organic food, Marion Nestle challenges the current food production and distribution system. She poses an important question. Doesn't the government's responsibility to protect its citizens trump the right of corporations to profit from consumers? Marion Nestle is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She's the author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, which won awards from the Association for American Publishers and the James Beard Foundation. Her book, What to Eat, was named one of Amazon.com's top 10 books of 2006 and a must-read by Eating Well magazine. She has also published Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua and the Coal Mine, and Feed Your Pet Right. Recently, Dr. Nestle, with over 55,000 followers, was named by Time Magazine as one of the 140 most influential Twitter feeds and a top 10 feed in the category of health and science. At this time, I would like to remind the audience to turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Please hold your questions until the question and answer session following the lecture. And now, please join me in welcoming Marion Nestle.
Thank you, Bryn, for that extremely nice introduction, and it's just a pleasure to be here. I've not been here before, and the college is beautiful, and spring is coming, and I can't think of anything nicer. So thank you very much for the invitation. It's really an honor to be here. I thought I would talk a little bit about my work, and I think of myself as a food systems researcher. I'm interested in the entire system of food production, all the way from production to consumption, agriculture, food, nutrition to public health. When I first started out in nutrition, I didn't think that agriculture had anything to do with the way people ate. And now I think you can't understand anything about the way we eat in America unless you understand the way our agricultural system works. And I'll try to explain what I mean by that as I go on. The issues in food systems that most concern me these days are listed here. Food insecurity, which I think is by far the most important and the one we need to deal with the most, and then obesity, which is becoming increasingly prominent, food processing and the way we market food, processed foods, especially to children, and then food safety and food sustainability. And I will say just a few things about each of those. Let me start with food insecurity because I think it's just an overwhelmingly important problem that we don't often think about or don't think enough about. In September last year, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations announced what passes for good news on the international scene. It announced that only 925 million people were defined by its standards as being chronically hungry, and this was down by 8 to 10% from the previous year, which is why it was good news. If you look at the figure on the left, which goes from about 1970 to the present, the number of hungry people in the world declined until the mid-1990s and then has started going up again and now is going up very precipitously as a result of all kinds of agricultural and other kinds of things that are happening in the world. And this isn't just an international or a global problem. It's also a problem in the United States, where the number of food stamp recipients shown on the right is also going up quite dramatically. On the international scene, we know how to end hunger and malnutrition. In last year, Science magazine had an article called Food Security, the Challenge of Feeding 9 Billion People, and I thought they had that completely wrong. It's not the challenge of our trying to figure out how to feed 9 billion people. It's getting 9 billion people to learn how to feed themselves and to take care of their own food needs. And there's been a great deal of research on what to do about hunger. And that research shows that almost any intervention is successful. And these interventions include such things as breastfeeding, providing clean water, having safe food, empowering women, educating people in general, teaching people how to do agriculture sustainably. But then in order to do all that, you need political stability and you need some kind of income equity. And of course, those are the issues that underlie all of these problems. I just want to point out that these are all social, non-technical and sustainable solutions to the problem of hunger. And it's why I think that that's why I think like a sociologist, I guess. These are sociological solutions and need to be approached from a sociological standpoint in order to solve them. It isn't enough to have a technical solution. Now, we live at a time of great irony, if you think that way, because even in developing countries, the number of hungry people has now been met or exceeded by the number of people who are obese. And this is happening everywhere in the world. And in fact, it's happening so rapidly, it has its own name. It's called the nutrition transition from periods of undernutrition to periods of overnutrition. And it's now the global paradox of obesity and malnutrition, feast or famine, is the way that Scientific American put it. And for those of us who care about obesity and are concerned about it, this is a very, very exciting time to be interested in these issues. Because we have, for the first time, certainly in my experience, the First Lady of the United States, who's interested in the same kinds of issues that I am. She has made childhood obesity her main focus of interest as First Lady, and she's chosen school food and access to food as inner cities as the places where she's most active in this, and I applaud her greatly for taking this on. It makes my work much easier. Now, I'm often asked what it is that people are supposed to eat, and I actually think it's very simple. If you're worried about obesity, you have to eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, don't eat too much junk food, enjoy what you're eating, and please don't eat my book. And if it seems more complicated than that, it is surely because of the effect of advice to eat less on the food industry. Eating less is very, very bad for business. And this was discussed, I thought, in a kind of nifty way by an executive of Coca-Cola a few years ago who gave an interview to Advertising Age in which she explained that obesity has become the Achilles heel of the food industry. It used to be this small, manageable issue that they didn't really have to think about. Now it's this huge global issue. It makes their marketing extremely difficult, and it's just this huge, huge issue for the food industry. So I want to talk a little bit about why that is. And in order to do that, one of the ways I like to think about it is the enormous change that has taken place in the way people think about childhood obesity just in the last few years. In 2002, when the first edition of Food Politics came out, everybody was talking about childhood obesity as a matter of parental responsibility, personal responsibility. If your kid was fat, it was because you as a parent weren't feeding your kids properly. 5 years later, when I did a new edition of Food Politics, the conversation had completely changed. Well, not completely, but had largely changed. And now everyone was talking about how our kids are supersized because of the food environment that we live in. And that doing something about childhood obesity is not just a matter of parental responsibility, but it's also a matter of social responsibility. And to understand why that is and what I mean by that, I think we have to go back to the dawn of the obesity epidemic, which wasn't that long ago. It was really in the early 1980s. Prior to the early 1980s, rates of obesity in the United States had been the same for decades. Starting in the early 1980s, the percentages of obese people in the population started going up. So we have to ask the question, what happened in the early 1980s that made people either move less or eat more or do both? Well, let me talk about the moving less part first. I don't want to push this too hard because the data are very, very hard to get. But most of the data that are accumulated by the Centers for Disease Control show that, if anything, rates of physical activity have gone up a little tiny bit since the early 1980s, counterintuitive as that may be. The CDC looks at it another way, and they measure rates of inactivity there. Rates of inactivity seem to have gone down a little bit. If rates of inactivity have gone down, it means rates of activity have gone up. I don't want to push this too hard, but let's agree at least that on the basis of existing data, rates of physical activity have not changed much in the last 25 or 30 years. Therefore, people must be eating more. There's no question about it. There are two sources of data on how many calories people eat every day. One is data on the amount of calories available in the food supply, and these are data that have been collected by the Department of Agriculture since the early part of the 20th century. In the early 1980s, the average number of calories available in the food supply per capita per day, that's men, women, little tiny babies, was 3,200 calories a day. It's now 3,900 calories a day, an increase of 700. Now, these are food supply data, the amount of food produced in the country, less exports plus imports. So it's not necessarily what people are actually eating. There's wastage. There are other problems. Probably people eat less than that. Dietary intake data, when you ask people what they're eating, they lie. Let's assume that they always lie the same amount over time. In the early 1980s, people reported eating an average of 1,900 calories a day. It's now 2,100, an increase of 200 calories a day. What the real number is, we don't know. The truth is probably someplace in between, but there's no question that people are eating more now than they did in the early 1980s. So, next question, how come? I think one of the major reasons has to do with agricultural policy. Starting in the 1970s, agricultural policy changed from paying farmers to not to grow food to paying farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could. Our farmers are extremely efficient, and they started producing more food. And this is shown in a long historical set of data on the number of calories in the food supply. Going back to 1910, that little pink band across the middle is 3,200 calories plus or minus a couple of hundred. Starting in the early 1980s, it went up to 3,900, as I've already explained. And even if you adjust all that for wastage, as the Department of Agriculture likes to do, it still is a sharp increase, and more calories than anybody needs or wants. What this did was to make the food industry extremely competitive. In order to sell a food in an environment in which there's almost twice as many calories as anybody needs, you know, the average is 2,000, 2,500, something like that, in this huge surplus of calories, the food industry had to be very competitive. But that was not all that happened in the early 1980s. The other really major event was a change in the way Wall Street evaluated food corporations. Before the early 1980s, Wall Street valued blue-chip stocks, something you never even hear about anymore. These were stocks that gave long, slow, continuous returns on investment over a very long period of time. The shareholder value movement, which is attributed to a speech by Jack Welch, who was then head of General Electric, and the speech was in 1981, Welch said that he thought shareholders deserved higher returns on investment very rapidly, immediate higher returns on investment. This changed the way that Wall Street evaluated corporations, and the result of the pressures that Wall Street has on corporations in general to increase their profits every 90 days, we see the mess on Wall Street now. But for food companies, it was especially difficult because food companies were already trying to compete in this environment of too many calories. Now they not only had to make a profit, but they had to grow their profits every 90 days and report growth to Wall Street on a quarterly basis. The result of that was that food companies had to find new ways to sell foods. And they did that very efficiently. And I'm going to show you what some of those ways are. Because there was so much food available, just supply and demand, food was cheap. People started eating outside the home more. Food outside the home has more calories than food inside the home. And much of the increase in the number of calories and the amount of money spent on food prepared outside the home was in fast food, where the calories are especially high. So all these are showing between the early 1980s and the early 2000s. So you can see how that went up. The most obvious thing that happened was that portion sizes got larger. This is my former doctoral student, now Dr. Lisa Young, who gives talks on the size of portions in the food supply. And here she is posed behind the white cup on the left, which is the standard Department of Agriculture serving size for soft drink. You can't even buy one anymore. And the others were all cups that she bought at our local movie theater. The cup on the left holds 8 ounces and about 100 calories. The cup on the right holds 64 ounces and 800 calories. And that the evidence shows that that double gulp is not passed down the aisle of the movie theaters and shared among everyone sitting on the row. It's consumed by one person. Larger portions have more calories. If I had one thing to teach, it would be that larger portions have more calories. You think it's obvious? No. And the fact that it's not obvious has been shown in a very clever experiment by Brian Wansink, who's a professor at Cornell University. And this is his famous Super Bowl experiment, in which he invited his own students, who should have known better, to come to his house and watch the Super Bowl. And he put half of them in one room with 2-quart bowls of snacks and the other half in another room with 4-quart bowls of snacks. And at the end of the Super Bowl, he counted up the number of calories they ate from the snacks, and he discovered that those who had the larger bowls ate nearly twice as many calories as those who had the smaller bowls. And when he asked them how many calories they thought they had eaten, the ones who had eaten the larger bowls underestimated their calorie intake by a much larger proportion than the ones who had the smaller bowls. Larger portions have more calories. Pay attention to that. Ubiquity is another one I love to ask the question, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? Now, you may not remember, but I certainly do, that when I came to NYU, the library had signs all over it saying, if you eat here, you are expelled from this university so quickly you won't even know what hit you, and now we have 2 cafes in the library. This is a way for the university to make money, and it's a way to sell more food. Food is everywhere, and the research shows that the more food there is available, the more places it is, the more people eat of it. Proximity is another one. If it's closer to you, you'll eat more of it, and one of the reasons why food advocates like me are so upset about vending machines in schools is that we know from the research that the more vending machines there are, the more people will, the more the students in the schools will buy from them. So these are all ways of increasing sales of food products. And the last is low prices. That's a result of all of the way we subsidize food and the way we pay farmers. And you can still go to McDonald's with $5 and buy 5 hamburgers or 1 salad. Does that make sense to you? It makes no sense to me. But that has to do with our agricultural policy and what we choose to subsidize and what we don't choose to subsidize. And if you hear poor people saying that they don't eat fruits and vegetables because fruits and vegetables are too expensive, it's because fruits and vegetables are too expensive. And this is shown by the Department of Commerce, which keeps data on indexed price of various food commodities over time. And the blue lines are the indexed price of fresh fruits and fresh vegetables from 1980 to the early 2000s. And during that period, the indexed price of fruits and vegetables went up by about 40%, whereas the indexed price of beer, butter, and sodas went down by 15 to 30%. So what we have then is an environment in which it looks like the government, in collaboration with industry, is creating an environment that encourages people to eat more because eating more is good for business. So this is the kind of thing that Michelle Simon, a lawyer in San Francisco, wrote about in her book, Appetite for Profit, how the food industry undermines our health and how to fight back. And in the book, she talked about how food advocates like me are putting pressure on food companies, regulators want to regulate them, lawyers want to sue them, and Wall Street simply wants food corporations to make more money every 90 days. And food companies reacted to these pressures at first by doing nothing, later by going through all the stages of death and denial, and then working hard to fight back and to change their products. Now, I'm not going to say very much about the way food industries fight back. I'm not going to say much about, I'll say a little bit about how they lobby, but I'm not going to talk about their attacks on advocates. If you want to know about that, you can look at I publish all their letters on my website. How they blame inactivity, how they blame personal choice, and how they try to co-opt advocates. So I'm not going to talk about that. What I am going to talk about is the way that they're changing products, particularly in health claims, functional foods, and self-endorsements, because this is what you see when you go to the grocery store. And it's what you're most familiar with. So let me start with health claims. We didn't used to have health claims on food packages. That only started in the early 1990s after Congress passed the Nutrition Labeling Health and Education Act of 1990, which forced the Food and Drug Administration to allow health claims on food packages if they were backed up by scientific agreement. The food industry was required by that law to put the nutrition facts labels on food products, and the food industry argued that if they had to say what was wrong with their products, how much salt, sugar, and whatever their products had, they should be allowed to say what was good about their products, and Congress agreed and told the FDA that it had to start allowing health claims. And the FDA did allow some health claims, like these, that were backed up by some science, but food companies wanted a lot more health claims to be allowed. And when the FDA turned them down because the science wasn't strong enough to back them up, the companies took the FDA to court. And the result was a series of cases which, in 2003, the FDA decided it just wasn't going to fight anymore because they had lost 8 of 10 First Amendment decisions, and they said that doing business the way they were doing was unsustainable, and they were going to stop fighting health claim cases. Now, what interests me about this is the business about the First Amendment, Because I don't know about you, but I learned in civics classes that the First Amendment was about the right to stand up and say what you believed about religion, your religious beliefs, and about your political beliefs. It never occurred to me that the First Amendment could be used to protect the right of food corporations to market junk foods to children. But that's the way the courts have interpreted it, and given the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, it's very unlikely that that situation is going to change, at least in the immediate future. So the current situation is if you go into a grocery store, you see health claims on everything, and sometimes health claims on the most ridiculous products imaginable. Since when is Fruity Pebbles, I love cereal boxes and I collect them, but since when is Fruity Pebbles, a cereal that has no fruit in it whatsoever, be an excellent source of vitamin D? Come on, give me a break. That Cocoa Krispies could help support your child's immunity because it's got some added vitamins, was actually so ridiculous that the city attorney of San Francisco subpoenaed Kellogg to produce evidence that proved that eating Cocoa Krispies could protect children's immunity, and you can imagine that that evidence might be hard to come by. And so that cereal box has now been withdrawn, and if you have one, it's a collector's item. Functional foods are another way in which the food industry is trying to promote food sales. And what functional foods are foods that have something extra beyond the normal nutrients that are ordinarily in a food that are added to improve health. These are all going to be processed foods of one kind or another. And the typical things that are added are listed here: vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, things that lower cholesterol, omega-3s, and so forth, probiotics and prebiotics, herbal supplements. The arrow shows the sale of functional foods from about the 1980s to the early 2000s. It's the only area of the food industry that shows any real growth these days. Everything else is pretty stagnant. Now, the interesting thing about functional foods is that remarkably little evidence backs up the use of them. And this is a functional juice product. Excuse me. This is a functional juice product from Nestle, no relation, that has DHA and omega-3 fatty acid added to it, and then Nestle is advertising this as something that will promote the brain development of children. Well, unfortunately, the research doesn't back that up, and this is some research from the last couple of years that shows that feeding mothers DHA during pregnancy doesn't do anything for the neurodevelopment of their young children. It doesn't make babies smarter. And the European Food Standards Agency, Food Safety Agency, has been rejecting one after another after another claims that DHA has anything to do with health. But that doesn't stop food marketers in the United States from using these claims. It also doesn't stop... It also doesn't get at the whole interaction between health policy and environmental policy. And DHA is a fatty acid that's found mainly in fish. And because of it, the American Heart Association recommends eating 2 servings of fish, preferably fatty fish such as tuna and salmon, every week. And that recommendation doesn't take into consideration the fact that seafood stocks in the oceans are declining very rapidly. And if things keep going the way they are, some experts extrapolate these downward curves in the number of fish to zero by the year 2050. And it also doesn't deal with the whole problem of fish pollution, either methylmercury or PCBs in fish. So I think that when we start looking at something as simple as DHA or as complicated as DHA, we really need to think of it not only as a nutritional issue, but as an issue that requires us to bring health policy and environmental policy together, which I don't see happening, but I think needs to be done. Okay, let me move on to self-endorsements. I love self-endorsements. Self-endorsements are when food companies, in this case PepsiCo, which owns Frito-Lay, sets up nutrition criteria for evaluating its own products and then applies those criteria to its own products. And guess what? Lots of their products qualify. And so here are cookies and chips that have this logo on them that indicates that these are better for you products. And when you talk to people at PepsiCo about advertising cookies and chips as health foods, they say, no, that's not what we're doing. We're marketing these products as better for you options. We're not saying they're healthy. We're saying they're better for you. So there were so many companies that did these self-endorsements that there were now self-endorsement logos all over package labels, and the companies thought that they were competing with each other too much, and so they started a process of trying to get together to have just one logo that would go on the front of packages to indicate better-for-you products, and it was the Smart Choices logo. And the... Unfortunately, the logo appeared first on Fruit Loops. And this caused consternation in the press and a lot of ridicule, because the criteria that had been set up for the Smart Choices logo was not to have any more than 25% of calories from added sugars, but Fruit Loops has 44% of calories from added sugars, and sugar is the first ingredient. And so the reporters asked the question, how could you do this? And they said, well, we made an exception for breakfast cereals, because breakfast cereals are the way that you get kids to drink milk. I posted something about this on my blog. I thought it was pretty ridiculous. And I posted the cereal box that I just showed you. And a week later, I got a call from an executive at Kellogg saying, you know, what you did was really unfair. So I said, what did I do that was unfair? And they said, well, we've changed our package, and we've now put 3 grams of fiber into Fruit Loop cereal, and we think you should be displaying the box that has the fiber in it. So that gave me a chance to discuss my favorite philosophical question, which is a, quote, better for you, unquote, product necessarily a good choice? And I think that's an interesting question that is well worth debating. Different people with different views will debate this differently. Now, as I said, one of the great problems that food companies have to deal with is how they can expand their market in a situation in which food is very competitive. And in fact, what's been happening is that a lot of the growth in packaged food sales has been coming from overseas sales. And last year, these are all articles from 2010, I read 3 stories about how Kraft profits were climbing on the result of sales in emerging markets. 3/4 of revenue of Coca-Cola's revenue is now coming from outside North America. That means United States and Canada. And PepsiCo's profits almost doubled on overseas beverages. So what that means is that these companies are, to the extent possible, moving into developing countries and pushing their products on emerging markets everywhere they can in the world. And I won't say too much about that, except to say that obesity is becoming a problem in many, many countries throughout the world. It's becoming a problem there for the same reasons that it's a problem here. And I'll just say one other thing about that, which is I was in Panama a couple of years ago, and I don't know what other people do when they go visiting other countries, but I go to grocery stores and buy Kellogg cereals. And I particularly love this one because it's Chocolate Sweeties is what this is. And it had an endorsement on it on the side from the Pediatric Association of Guatemala, which has a partnership with Kellogg to endorse its products. And I don't, I think because it has 12 vitamins fortified in it. So sometimes health professionals get involved in these situations in ways that I think are awkward and set up a conflict of interest, so much so that a colleague and I wrote an article for the Journal of the American Medical Association a couple of years ago asking the question, can the food industry play a constructive role in the obesity epidemic? A question that I think can be debated in many, many different ways, but we were particularly concerned that the goals of industry, which are to promote profits, don't necessarily agree with public health goals, which is to make people healthy. And in a situation in which people would be healthier if they ate less, industry goals come into conflict. And I think it's a really serious problem in thinking about this. All right, let me move on and say just a couple of words about food safety, which is a huge issue right now. I think people should be taking to the streets to complain that our food supply isn't safe enough. If ever there was an area that needed advocacy, I think food safety is one of them. And one of the reasons is that we don't really have a food safety system in the United States that works for the whole country or for all products. Instead, we have a food safety system that's highly fragmented that was developed in 1906. I'm not kidding about this. The 1906 rules still pretty much govern what we do in food safety. And as a result of those rules, the 1906 rules, which came out as a result of Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, our food safety system is divided between USDA, which regulates meat and poultry, and the FDA, which regulates pretty much everything else, as if waste from meat and poultry didn't contaminate vegetables, which unfortunately it does. So in the last few years, we've seen an astonishing list of major national recalls of one food after another, some of them quite bizarre, not only ground beef and salami, but cheese, pre-prepared frozen cookie dough, eggs, jalapeno peppers, tomatoes, peanuts, pet food. I wrote a book about that one, and pistachios. I mean, it's just one food after another. So far this year, the FDA has issued 103 recalls. I read on a newsletter that came around this morning. Somebody is keeping track of these. Foods are constantly being recalled because they have one harmful bacteria or another. Now, starting in 1992, what was then the General Accounting Office is now the Government Accountability Office, a watchdog arm of Congress, started publishing reports calling for a single food safety agency that would bring the functions of the USDA and the FDA together. And the themes in the reports that have come out since 1992, the most recent one came out this year, is that there should be a single agency because you can't separate animals and plants. They shouldn't be regulated by two agencies. The food safety system should cover all foods. It should cover them from farm to table. And include regulations, testing, inspection, and enforcement. The shocking thing is that we don't have that right now. We don't. Now, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decided that it was politically infeasible to develop a single food safety agency. So they have granted the FDA the power to regulate all foods from farm to table with regulations and enforcement. So the FDA, for the foods under its jurisdiction, will have those rules. But Congress has not appropriated any funding to the FDA to do that. So it's quite unclear how all of that is going to work out. And in fact, one of the really bizarre businesses about this is the FDA, which is a health agency and is part of Health and Human Services, gets its funding because of historical reasons from the House and Senate Agricultural Committees, and which are not very interested in anything that the FDA does. So until that situation gets settled, I don't know whether we're ever going to have a decent food safety system. Of course, the solution to the problem was given by The Onion, which always has brilliant solutions to major social problems, and their approach is simply to approve salmonella or any E. coli, and then we won't have any problems. Now, I would be depressed. Oh, I was going to say something about the sustainability as well. Sustainability is a big issue right now, and those of you who are fortunate to hear Anna Lappe speak of, I don't know, when was she here? This week, last week? Her book about diet for hot planet is really terrific. And there's a great deal of work coming out now talking about the importance of agriculture for climate change and other kinds of sustainability problems. My favorite of all of these books is a book from New Zealand called Time to Eat the Dog. I wrote a book about pet food, so this is a very sensitive issue to me. But their point was that if you really wanted to live sustainably, you shouldn't have pets because they eat and they take up a lot of room and they're environmentally unsustainable. They didn't say you shouldn't have children, but I thought the implication was clear. It's actually a pretty good book. Agriculture, to everybody's great surprise, is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, somewhere in the ballpark. I don't know what the exact range is, and I don't know whether I believe any of these figures because I don't really understand the assumptions that go behind them, and they're different depending on who's doing the assumptions. But the range for agriculture is about 10 to 20% of greenhouse gas emissions, right in the ballpark of transportation. So a lot of people are really concerned about how we do agriculture in order to try to make it a little bit more environmentally friendly. As I say, it's very hard to get estimations, and the estimations all differ, but this came out about the environmental cost of Tropicana orange juice, which has been estimated at 3.7 pounds of carbon dioxide for a half gallon of Tropicana juice. And much of that comes from the distribution and production of the juice, that these are environmentally, they require energy, and the distribution requires energy. And so it's electricity, natural gas, a lot of it comes from the fertilizer production and application. So we need to start thinking about the way we're producing foods. And this has led a lot of people to look at the difference in carbon dioxide per pound from vegetable foods and animal foods. And it's very clear that animal foods have a much higher contribution to greenhouse gases than do vegetable foods. And that, let me go back to that for just a second. And so what's interesting to me about this is that the kind of recommendations for an environmentally healthy diet are exactly the same as the recommendations for a personally healthy diet. So agriculture and public health come very close together. Now, I think we're at a very exciting time right now because we're in the middle of a food revolution. And it's not just Alice Waters, who's shown in the upper one, in the upper picture here, who believes that we're in the middle of a food revolution. And I love showing this because that's me underneath her, holding a box of cereal, of course. And the revolution I teach food sociology, and so this isn't a revolution like typical social movements, because it's fragmented among organizations and groups with very, very different goals, although collectively they all have the goal of having a food system that is better for the planet and better for people. The revolution has to do with food production. We have the organic revolution, the slow food revolution, the locavore revolution, the grow your own food revolution, and the produce animals more humanely revolution. And there are many, many groups that are working on all of these issues, I think, in a very exciting way. And both organic and local food are increasing. The revolution is also focused on consumption, and a lot of things are happening where cities, states, and the federal government are enacting legislation to try to make the food system friendlier to people and healthier for people to eat, or to make it easier for people to choose more healthful diets. And what I'm showing here is when President Obama signed the health reform legislation last year, it has embedded within it a provision that requires menu labeling in fast food restaurants and chain restaurants, and that will be coming sometime next year. New York City is way ahead of the game. We have a very, very activist health commissioner who is working very hard on calorie labeling, on front of package labeling, on trying to reduce the amount of salt in the food that's served in New York, and most particularly on trying to do something about sodas. And I don't know if any of you have been in New York City subways lately, but they're filled with these posters saying that show how much sugar goes into soft drinks, for example. So that this particular poster says your kid just ate 26 packs of sugar. Most people don't have any idea how much sugar and sweetener there is in the sodas they're eating. And there's a big push now to try to tax sweetened, sugar-sweetened beverages. And what's interesting to me, I said I would say just a little bit about lobbying, is that the Los Angeles Times managed to dig up lobbying figures for the combination of Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and the American Beverage Association, which are very eager not to have soda taxes. And up until 2008, they were spending a couple of $1 million a year on lobbying. In 2009, when the soda tax issue became very prominent, they spent $40 million on lobbying. So one of the reasons why we don't have soda taxes is because they've been very effective on that. And I'm sure you've heard about the Philadelphia city council wanted to pass a soda tax for Philadelphia, and the soda companies, particularly Coca-Cola, bribed the city council and said that it would give $10 million donation to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia if they would drop the soda tax provision, and they did. And those people who have estimated how much money Coca-Cola will make in Philadelphia as a result of not having it taxed show that Coke won on that one, although I suppose Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is happy about it. So all of these things sound like government, and they really are about democracy. Many, many magazines have had articles about the global food crisis and the cost of food and what the food systems or situations really are. But The Nation, which is a left-wing magazine, had my favorite comment, which was, "Food for All is really about how to grow democracy." And I think that the food revolution is really a very democratic food revolution. It's of the people, by the people, for the people, and it's very much from the bottom up. And so that produces a situation in which individuals can exercise their democratic right as citizens and vote with their fork. And if I were going to make recommendations about how to exercise your personal responsibility about food choices, I would say buy food, not products. Eat smaller portions if you're worried about obesity. Buy local for a whole lot of reasons. You want to support your local farmers. cook at home and teach kids how to cook. It's the most radical thing you can do to get kids to understand what food is about, where it comes from, and what real food tastes like. But I also think that we as citizens should exercise social responsibility, and this means changing policy. And I have a great big long list of policies that I think would be worth working on the agricultural side: farmers markets, urban farming, local farming, organic and sustainable production, and then farm supports. The farm bill is coming up for renewal starting next year, and there will be many, many groups that are working on the farm bill to try to have a more rational system of supporting agriculture so that it meets health goals as well as the economic goals of farmers. And then I think we need to do something about our food safety law so our food supply is safer. On the public health side, there's plenty that we could do in schools about neighborhood access, about marketing to kids, cleaning up food labels, and then I think the root of corruption in American government is the way that corporations are allowed to fund campaigns, election campaigns, and at some point we're going to need to do something about that. And I also think it's time to look at the way that we allow Wall Street to operate. These are all, some of these are local and easier to do, and some of them are pipe dreams in the present political climate, but they're still worth thinking about how it would be possible to improve the system, to have a food system that would make it easier for people to eat more healthfully. For those of you who are lucky enough to be in Pennsylvania, there are plenty of places in which you can get involved. PASA is an extraordinary organization. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture is an absolutely remarkable organization, and there are lots of ways in which you can support fresh and local food, farmers markets, and so forth. And I love the edible magazines. I think they're really terrific. And you've got, I think, at least one of them in Pennsylvania. So this is all about democracy in action, and I hope you'll join the food revolution in whatever way seems most comfortable, interesting, exciting, and delicious for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Professor. During our question and answer session, we'll have two students with microphones, so please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question.
She who holds the microphone holds the floor.
Indeed. Guys, anyone got a question?
Nobody wants to argue, even?
Hi, I just have a question for you about the food safety bill that's being worked on. What are some of your thoughts for what should be a part of the food safety bill?
Actually, this food safety bill has been passed.
Sorry, changes to the food safety bill.
Oh, how it should be changed? I think there should be a single food safety agency. I mean, my understanding about the way the food safety bill only deals with the FDA. And my understanding from Washington insiders is that the hope would be that first they would fix the FDA and give the FDA recall authority and the ability to inspect and do all of those things, and then they would go back to USDA. USDA has regulations that govern the safety of meat and poultry. They just don't enforce them. So they could tweak that. And then the idea would be to make the rules in both agencies the same, and then that would make it possible to create a single food safety agency that would do it. If you don't give the FDA resources, it's not going to be able to do it. It has an impossible job anyway. It has to inspect all the foods that come in from international countries. It has to govern 100,000 restaurants. I mean, it's really an impossible task, and so they're supposed to develop a risk-based system that singles out what the highest risk products are and try to focus on those. The big issue over the food safety bill was whether those rules would hurt small farmers. I don't know whether they will or not. I think we have to wait and see. and just see how it plays out. But if there's no money to do it, I mean, what Congress has adored doing over the last 20 years is giving the FDA mandates and no money to carry them out. And that makes, you know, that paralyzes the agency. I think we need a strong regulatory agency. I'm in favor of regulation because it's the only way. First of all, it establishes a level playing field that I think is better for industry. I think industry does better if there's a level playing field. So I would like to see rules stronger rather than weaker.
I just want to follow up on that question because one of the issues with the food safety bill is its impact on small farmers. Mm-hmm. And so by creating a regulatory system that includes both the industrial size farms with mm-hmm. small family farms, that's a big concern within the...
Yeah, there were provisions in the bill that gave small farmers somewhat of a break. But I think small farms should be producing safe food without question. And I think we just have to wait and see how it plays out.
Hi, what do you think is, okay, what's your view on the implications of urban farming on food security and sustainable food?
Oh, I think it's terrific.
You're
opting out of the food system, in a sense, if you're growing your own food. I live in New York City where there are urban farms springing up everywhere. I have a terrace on my apartment. I grow food on my terrace. I'm self-sufficient in salad during the summer. Everybody could grow a little food. You can grow onions in a pot in a windowsill. Everybody can grow food. It's not that hard to do. It's not that complicated, and it means that people know. I know that whatever food I grow is local, organic, seasonal, and sustainable. So I even compost.
Well, how do you think of the conflict between available space in such a mega populated city like New York?
Oh, there's space. I mean, I'm at New York University, which is a big urban university. It has loads of land that is planted in flowers or nothing. And there's a big push at the university to try to start growing vegetables on it. And one of the amazing things to me is how much resistance there has been in the administration of the school to doing that when it seems to me it would be really easy to do. The gardener wanted to grow vegetables in planters on the street, and he did one summer when nobody was looking. But the administration is very hostile to the whole idea. But I think there's land. You can grow a lot of food in a very, very small space. I was fortunate enough yesterday to have a tour of the White House garden. And I think the most shocking thing about it was how heavily it was guarded. I felt sorry for any rabbit that tried to eat anything there. There's a lot of security. But all the White House garden is a few raised beds. It's a very small space. It's much smaller than this room, for example. And yet they're growing food there that's feeding White House staff and the Obamas and whatever. He's out there picking spinach and kale for dinner even now. It's not that hard. And the more people, and it's fun. It's really fun to grow your own food. So I'm for it.
What's your take on Walmart getting into the local farms business? Is this co-opting the movement, or are they bringing good local food to the populace?
It's both. I don't know what they're doing. I want to see it. I haven't seen it yet. I know what the promises are, and if I see, you always worry about Walmart because they're so tough on their employees. And when you have a corporation that keeps its workforce so underpaid, then you worry about whether they're going to try to keep their farmers' suppliers underpaid as well. And so I want to see what they actually do. They've made a lot of promises. So far, I haven't seen what they're doing. I've seen organic produce in Walmart at shockingly low prices. I don't know how they get it or where they get it from. I know they get fish from China and other foods from the Far East. And you just wonder about what kind of a food supply that is when low cost is the thing that governs everything they do. So I'm waiting to see how this plays out before deciding whether it has benefits or not.
What do you think about a semi-self-regulatory system, kind of like TRI, where companies have to regulate themselves and constantly, I don't know, put out the data about what's in or the health risk about their food, but then every once in a while there's someone checking up to make sure that that's actually actually doing a good job of regulating that?
Yeah, I'm not aware that self-regulation works very well. I mean, there's a lot of history about that. You know, it's the fox guarding the chickens kind of thing. I think you need external third-party regulators to keep the system honest. But that's just my opinion.
Hi there. I'm coming from the side room here. I was wondering if you could touch a bit on nutrition-based education for schools and perhaps its role in the obesity epidemic and what or how it could evolve.
I actually favor food-based education in schools and everywhere else. I don't think people need to know nutrients at all. If you're eating a healthy diet, the nutrients take care of themselves. But I'm very concerned about food-based education. By food-based education, it's not only what a balanced diet is, but that would be a big part of it, but also where those foods come from, how they're grown, how they're produced, and how they're cooked. That's what I'd like to see. Very, very closely tied to what goes on in the cafeteria, with nutrients very much secondary and maybe covered in science classes. I don't think you need to know anything about nutrients. You have to know a lot about food and balance.
Hi. I was wondering if you could identify, or if you thought there were, like, where are the largest economic gains? Like, if you were going to make an argument to companies, to the government, for economics with the deficit, with all these sort of things, is there any room that you can make an argument that these sort of changes would improve available funds for the masses?
You know, I'm really sorry, but I can't hear what you're saying.
I'm sorry.
Can somebody either translate for me?
It's
something about the way the sound is hitting up here.
No, I'm sorry. Where are the largest economic gains in these changes, like in these changes that you're proposing? Like
the economic gains?
Yeah.
There will be winners and losers in any change in the food supply. Right now, the big economic gains are in organics. Organic sales are increasing as a percentage and in total number. And I don't see any reason why that can't continue. I'd like to see it continue. I think a lot of people really care about where food comes from and how it's produced and are willing to pay more for food that's produced according to their values. I think we need to change the way we support agriculture, and that will produce winners and losers. But that's how our system works. Not everybody can win, right? And right now, I think the balance is in favor of industrial agriculture in a way that's not good for the planet, not good for animals, not good for the communities in which these places exist. You go into the Midwest, and the towns are dead because there's one enormous corporation that owns huge amounts of land, and you want to bring back smaller farmers in order to populate those areas. People are still going to have to eat. And I don't think industrial agriculture is going to go away, but I think it needs to produce food in a way that's more environmentally friendly. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm going to stand up because I don't think you could see
thank
me.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your comments on the food revolution, which I think I really enjoyed the way, especially you talked about it being a revolution of the people. But I know from what we were talking about a little bit before dinner, my own work on the stigmatization of fat people is really a concern. And what concerns me is the kind of conflation of the food revolution with, you know, fat people being a problem. So that there's a lot of focus on fat people, and I know particularly in the work with Michelle Obama, there's a lot of concern among fat activists in the nation that fat kids especially are really being kind of, you know, this is yet another way where they're being pinpointed as being a particular kind of problem. And so that exacerbates that issue where the issues of the food supply, the food safety, the food quality, et cetera, are issues for everyone, whether a body is thin or a body is fat. And so I'm wondering if you could respond to that and just think through for us what your thoughts are on the kind of conflation of food activism and the possibilities for actually food activists and fat activists working together.
Well, I think it would be nice if they worked together. I want to see the overweight in kids prevented, so that it becomes a non-issue. I mean, there is absolutely no question that that rates of childhood obesity have increased, and these are not trivial problems. Yesterday's USA Today had an article about menarche in 7-year-old girls, and the leading hypothesis for why this is happening is overweight in children. You know, children used to be skinny. They really did. They were outside playing. They were running around. They weren't eating as much, and they certainly weren't drinking sodas. So I think we need to create a food environment for kids in which kids are eating more healthfully and being more active, and then it would be prevented. And we wouldn't have to deal with a societal problem in which it's not fair to blame the kids for what's happened to them. And it's much, much harder to lose weight than it is to prevent weight gain in the first place. So in a sense, I'm not at all in favor of stigmatization. But I see this as a societal problem that needs to be prevented.
And then I'll go.
Okay. Hi. I'm interested in your inclination for a regulatory agency for food, a single regulatory agency.
For food safety.
Yes, ma'am. How can you ensure the success of small farms, of local farms, of organic farms on a tight budget?
I'm sorry. I don't understand the question. Can you explain a little bit more?
Yes. I just rehearsed that question as I said it in my head a whole bunch of times, so I have to rethink it out again. Yeah.
I don't want to try to guess what you mean.
Certainly. Given that if such an agency did arise in our government spontaneously, it's not going to have a lot of money to operate to ensure food safety for the public. How can you ensure that through incentives or punishments, or is it just a matter of re-networking the food subsidies in our nation? Or
no, it's much more complicated than that. I think everybody should be producing safe food no matter what size they are. And the question is, how do you do that, and how do you know enough to do it? And, you know, I have lots and lots of anecdotes about situations in which food is produced unsafely. Most farmers that I've met really care about food safety. They don't want to poison their customers. You know, they think they're producing food for people. They don't want to kill them. So they're doing what they can. But there are always, in these situations, a few bad actors that ruin things for everybody else. And I would say that some of the worst recalls in the last few years were by actors who were so bad that they just take your breath away. The peanut guy, for example. You know, I mean, he had been testing his peanut butter. He knew it had salmonella in it. So the test came back positive for salmonella. So he sent it out to another lab until he got the result he wanted. And then lots of people got sick and some died. So that was a bad actor. The pistachio people produced pistachios that were found to have salmonella in them. They were recalled. They repackaged them. under a different label and sent them out again. Excuse me. You know, that sets up a situation where you have to have regulation, regulation, regulation to try to prevent something that never should have happened in the first place. So you want to have rules that where you have a, you want to have rules where you go into the risk situations, where people are, where you have an occasional inspection, where you can pick up where corners are being cut. I think there is so much economic pressure on food companies that some companies are willing to cut corners. And what shocks me about the whole thing is that, I don't know if you remember the spinach recall of 2006. It was really terrible because lots of people died. It was an E. coli 0157H7 recall. And the spinach was grown on an organic farm that was still in transition but wasn't certified. And it was packed by the largest organic vegetable packer in the country, Earthbound Farms. The Earthbound Farms people were devastated by what happened. And they resolved that nothing like that, they wanted to stay in business, nothing like that was ever going to happen again. And so they hired a microbiologist, they redid their entire procedures, they now test everything that comes into the plant, they test everything that goes out of the plant, they test and hold. They have absolutely state-of-the-art procedures, you know, really well worked out. And when I visited the plant, I asked them how much it cost them to do that. Now, what does it cost to put in state-of-the-art food safety procedures? And they said, well, our volume is so great, it's a penny a crate. I think we can afford a food safety system that works. I really do. I don't think anybody would mind paying a penny on something to be sure that the food had a better chance of being safe. It's not going to be 100%. You're never going to get 100% because we're talking about biology and things happen. But we sure could do a lot better than we're doing. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of how I think about it. We can afford a safer system. And small farmers can produce food safely. And I don't think at huge expense.
Hi, over here. I guess I have two, if you'll allow me. One is in regards to the New York City in terms of food labeling. I'm not sure if you're able to, if you know of any, or you're able to comment on any data for the effects of the labeling and whether it's made a difference mm-hmm. in consumer purchasing. Mm-hmm. And also in terms of different phenomena that affect food purchasing, if there's, you touched upon just right now, organic, if there's an organic phenomena, certain cereals, since you like cereals, can sweeten things with mm-hmm. organic cane sugar, and it still have similar nutritional mm-hmm. implications as a Fruit Loops.
Those are two completely different questions.
So you can comment either
All
or
right.
both.
Let me deal with the organic one first. And organic junk food is still a junk food. You know, I don't know. I gave a talk some years ago at a meeting of the organic. I can't even remember what, Organic Producers Association, something. I can't remember what it was called. I thought I was going to be talking to small organic farmers in Birkenstocks, and I was introduced by the vice president for General Mills. I thought, oops, wrong talk, wrong audience. And I said at that I thought the organic industry should not be making junk foods because there was a sort of an ethical and a, you know, sort of a expectation that organics would be better than that. But they didn't listen to me. So an organic junk food is still a junk food, and Brian Wansink, who I referred to, has a research paper out in which he shows that if a product is labeled organic, people think it's healthy, whether it is or not, and they think it has fewer calories. So that's kind of fun. Just because it's organic doesn't mean it's calorie-free. I think you mean on the menu label. labeling, the menu labeling in restaurants has been in New York now for 2 or 3 years, and lots of people have done research to see whether having menu labeling changes consumer purchases. Let me say that I think this research is really hard to do, because when I go into one of these places, and I go to Pan Quotidien, which is a chain in New York City, and I see that this chocolate cookie is 670 calories, I'm not going to buy it. I might buy something else that was 670 calories, but I'm not going to buy that. What the research is showing in study after study after study is very, very small differences on average. So that, you know, maybe on average it would be 50 calories less or 50 calories more. Menu labeling makes some people eat more. It makes some people eat less. It has no effect on other people. I think it's too early to tell. What I'm hoping is two things. I'm hoping, first of all, that the companies will reduce the number of calories in some of their products so that they can mark them as lower. And I'm hoping that people will understand that larger portions have more calories. If it does that, it will be making a major, major, major educational gain for people, because I think people don't understand that very well, at least not in my experience. So I kind of think, you know, again, it's too early to tell. And it'll be very interesting to see it when it comes in and we have it national, whether anybody pays any attention to it or not. I pay attention to it. No.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question. If you could expand on the idea of the pace of political processes and the history behind the actual policy, how that influences.
Which policy? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Like just political process in general, how long it takes before something goes through.
Oh, you want a civics lesson?
Yeah.
A quick civics lesson?
Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, the FDA, I'm going to talk about the FDA, which is the agency that I probably work with the most and know the best. If the FDA wants to, the FDA decided that it was going to do something about front-of-pack labeling, that it wanted to preempt what all of these food companies were doing in putting logos on their food and develop a single symbol that would go on food that all companies would have to use if they were going to use a front-of-package label. So that started 2 years ago, and in order to do that, they needed, everything has to be evidence-based, so they needed research. So they commissioned a study from the Institute of Medicine, which is one of these research places in Washington, to do a study. The Institute of Medicine has come out with its first report, but there's a second report that's coming, and that's not going to come until late this year. And then after that, on the basis of those reports, FDA will start a rulemaking process, in which it will start the process of writing regulations for how these front-of-package labels will work. So first it has to announce in the Federal Register that it's starting rulemaking. Then it has to open that up for comments for some period of time, probably 90 days. Then it has to deal with the comments and propose the rules. Then it has to open those up for comments, probably 90 days, and then respond to those comments. And it may have to go through that 2 or 3 times before it finally can promulgate a rule. It's like moving the Titanic. It's like a glacier. Or the way glaciers used to be before there was global warming. It's excruciating, absolutely excruciating. The government moves very, very slowly in order to make sure that everybody gets input. It's painful. There's another one that's going on now that, the whole business with menu labeling was fast. Obama signed the law in February. The FDA was required to produce rulemaking by March 23rd. They missed it by a week, which is bad. So they've now proposed rules. They're in a comment period now. If you think that there should be movie labeling in movie theaters, as I do, you should be writing the FDA about it right now, because the comment period's open for another couple of weeks. And I've blogged about this. If you want to know about it, you can read all about it on my blog. Then they will get comments back. They will spend some months reviewing those comments. They'll propose new rules. Maybe by next year we'll have menu labeling. I don't know how long it'll take. But this is all mandated by Congress. You don't like this, you got to complain to your congressional representatives. The agencies do what Congress wants.
We have about four or five more questions that we're going to try and fit in. So.
Okay.
Hi. So you talked about the food revolution and how local and organic food may be part of the solution. But as you well know, that food revolution has been criticized, especially local and organic food, has been criticized as being an elitist movement. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what your views are on that. If you think that's a barrier? And if so, how can we overcome that?
Yeah, of course it's a barrier. And that was why I showed the slide that indexed prices of fruits and vegetables really are higher. They really are expensive. But there's a reason why they're expensive. They're not subsidized. So this is a matter of federal agricultural policy, and it's why the Farm Bill, which is coming up for renewal next year, is going to be so heavily fought over in a way that it's never been fought over before. You know, it started a little bit in 2005, but many, many, many organizations are gearing up to try to propose pieces of the Farm Bill that will make it easier for people to buy fruits and vegetables. You know, if subsidies went to fruits and vegetables, they'd be cheaper than processed foods. Or you could buy five salads for $5 and one hamburger, maybe. You know, let's bring agricultural policy in line with health policy. And on my blog last week, what I'm trying to do is to acquire a list of resources for people to get involved. And I put up a list of the resources that I had for people who want to get involved in Farm Bill advocacy. And then people have written in with others. And eventually I'll put the whole thing together as Q&As. But there are lots of organizations that are working on these issues, and they would welcome help, I'm sure. If this is an issue that you care about, this is a really good one.
Hi, I had a question. I understand that some countries have banned food advertising to children or limited it to children. Any movement towards that in the United States?
Not as long as Citizens United... it stands. We can't touch it. It's First Amendment. Can't touch it. And the FDA is unwilling to take that on because they're sure they'll lose. So we have, as long as corporations in the United States have the rights of individuals, which I don't think they should have. I do not think the founding fathers of the United States were sitting around a conference table saying, let's write the First Amendment to protect the right of food marketers. I don't think that was the intention of it. But that's how the Supreme Court is currently interpreting these things. And until that changes, or until there's a grassroots movement to change it, I think we have to find other ways to try to deal with these issues. I think there are other ways, and I hope lots of people are looking for them.
I was very glad to hear you begin your talk this evening with your comments on hunger in the world. There have been criticisms raised against sustainable agricultural practices as not being up to the challenge
I heard Dennis Avery speak a couple of weeks ago.
So there's been this criticism that sustainable agriculture is not up to the challenge of producing enough food for 9 billion people or whatever it might be in coming decades. Mm-hmm. Some 30 years ago, Amartya Sen wrote a good response to that, which is that... hunger is not a problem of there not being enough food to eat. Mm-hmm. It's a problem of access.
Entitlement.
And many of the strategies that you identified for dealing with hunger are ones that really address more the entitlement, the access. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you might elaborate on some of those in response to this debate of can sustainable agriculture feed the world.
Well, actually, I have another answer to it, which is the research shows that it can. There are real studies on this. And not only are there real studies, but there have been real studies that go back 30 and 40 years, published in very respectable journals like Science Magazine and other places like that. I review some of this in my book, What to Eat, where I talk about organic agriculture, and I deal with that issue directly. I think the research shows that sustainable agriculture is almost as productive as industrial agriculture. It's not as productive, but it's 90, 95% as productive and much, much kinder to the soil, the water, the environment. It replenishes the soil, so we don't have that problem of having to put in more and more and more fertilizer all the time. I mean, it makes so much sense. What was disappointing to me about Dennis Avery is he doesn't give any data. He doesn't even try to make a logical argument for the kind of position that he has. And he was debating somebody who had facts and figures right there. I didn't understand it. I think an argument, I don't mind, I think you can make an argument, but let's talk about real data. I didn't see any. And I think the data are very clear that organic and sustainable agriculture is productive. You know, I'm astounded by the amount of food that I can grow on a small scale upstate New York, at a house I have upstate New York, completely self-sufficient in vegetables for the summer on a couple of raised beds. It's not that hard. You know, scaling it up in a large way is hard to think about, but most of our huge industrial agriculture is designed to feed animals. So that's another issue that plays into this. If we were eating fewer animals, there would be less. This is where the who wins and who loses comes in. But if we were eating fewer animals, I'm not saying no animals, because I think animals fertilize and there's a cycle here that's very important. But the productivity, I just don't see it as an issue. The issue is income inequity, which is a really big one that nobody ever wants to talk about.
Hi. While we wait for changes in agricultural policy, do you have any insights on how we might be able to educate those that that lack what they need when they go to the grocery store to make valuable choices, to educate them without insulting them, and then also to help those that can't afford it, even with supplemental nutrition assistance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you raise a really important point, is how do you do this without being condescending and insulting? And the big issue for poor people is they don't have enough money. That's the issue. If they had enough money, maybe, you know, if they had enough money, they would have the education that goes along with enough money, and so forth and so on. So I think everybody, even poor people, want to feed their kids right if they have the opportunity to do it. And my favorite current policy is double your food stamps if you spend them on fruits and vegetables, you know? Doesn't even show, you just give them your benefit card and you get twice as much. And there are quite a number of places that are doing pilot projects on this. They work really well. Guess what? People buy more fruits and vegetables if they don't cost as much. So we need to think about it as an income support or something like that. And other than that, you teach kids to cook. And you let the kids take it from there. I've seen it. It works really well. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a lot of kids.
We're going to take our last question of the evening.
And who gets the last one?
Thank you for a wonderful talk. A lot of the terminology that you use, we've heard throughout the year, our speakers on food security, food safety, join a food revolution. But I'm wondering if you can define what food is in this context, because I think you and I and the people in this room know that apples are food, carrots are food, breast milk is food, but Twinkies and Ho-Hos and Four Loko is just
maybe just edible.
Food-like objects. It's not Michael food. Pollan calls them food-like objects.
So, but I ask with a caveat because I wonder in your talk about the need for better policy and regulation, if we separate food from edible others, are we in danger then of exposing ourselves to more risk with those edible others if they're not regulated in the same way that our food, our necessary food should be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess from a strictly nutritionist standpoint, a food is anything that has calories or nutrients. I mean, so that would processed foods would be included in that because they have calories and nutrients. Some of them have a lot of nutrients, and lots of them have fortified nutrients. So they're put in there for that purpose. I don't think that processed foods are going to go away, but I see processing as being the new frontier in the food revolution. Several major articles have come out in professional journals within the last 6 months on the difference between highly processed foods and relatively unprocessed foods. It's hard to figure out where the line is, but the issue is the degree of processing and the nutritional value and the health benefits and the ability to prevent overweight comes from eating foods that are relatively low in nutritionist term nutrient density, which is the proportion of nutrients for the number of calories that you have. And foods of low nutrient density are fruits and vegetables. Foods of high nutrient density are sodas, for example. And, you know, so you can start thinking about it that way. But what impresses me about it is that the dietary advice in this is always to eat the same foods that have been recommended. You know, in my formulation, which is eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, and don't eat too much junk food. You know, that takes care of really a lot of things, a lot of problems. Not that you don't eat no junk food; you just don't eat very much of it. So.
On behalf of the Clark Forum, please join me again in thanking Professor Nestle for her team. And this concludes our presentation tonight. Thank you for attending.